As we look at the melancholy temperament, thank you. Yeah, the whole thing, that's right. Just wonderful. Thank you so much. These marvelous proofs. It's so exciting, really, to see you give me examples. And I appreciate this because I've been doing this now for 12 years. I have been thinking in temperaments. I see people in them. It helps me a great deal in relating to people and also in counseling with other people. Because when you do know a person's temperament, which as you get used to this, you'll be able to judge quite quickly, as you get used to using the temperaments in counseling with people, you're able to anticipate in your own mind the kind of problems that they have. And if you see a sanguine person, let's say a sanguine girl married to a melancholy man, you don't have to know anything more about them than those two temperaments, and you can do almost a scenario of how things go at home with them. And you'll be right most of the time. So as we learn these temperaments, they help us to understand other people, not to put labels on them, not to judge them, but to be able to deal with them and understand them. So again, our principles in doing this are, number one, to understand ourselves so that I can see what my strengths are and work to amplify them, and so that I can look at my areas of weakness, which even though I may not have thought they were weaknesses in the past, I realize now are offensive to other people, and prayerfully work to get over these areas of weakness. So that's the area with me. And the second step is to understand other people and to realize that just because someone is different from me does not automatically make him wrong. Now, as we look into the melancholy person, we have so far today seen the sanguines and the cholerics, who are both outgoing, optimistic, extroverted, ones that relate well to people and who want always to be out in the forefront. Now, the other two temperaments that we're going to look at now, the melancholy and the phlegmatic, have many similarities. The melancholy is an introverted person, and so is the phlegmatic, and they are both born innately pessimistic. Now, when you understand this, it helps you to deal with a person who constantly is seeing the negative of something. And you will understand that they are not trying to be difficult, but that that is the way their viewpoint goes. Now, God created us all differently. He created us to be unique. And each one of us has certain strengths. No one temperament is better than the other one. No temperament is the one we all want to be. Each temperament has equal amount of strengths as they have weaknesses. And with each set of strengths come comparative weaknesses. And we will see this as we go along this afternoon into the weaknesses. So we do not want to say, well, the sanguine cholerics are the fun, wonderful people to be, and the melancholy phlegmatics are not the ones to be. That's not the case at all. Only a sanguine would think that. But because they want everybody to be having fun and never getting pulled together. And so as we look at this, the melancholies are the people who have the greatest and deepest strengths of any of the temperaments. And as we look at this, we will see that the melancholy strengths in the emotional area are that they are deep and thoughtful. They think everything through. They are the thinkers of life. They are talented and creative. They're genius prone. Now, this is great. For those of you that are melancholy, you can realize that you are in the top group of people who really have the ability to be the geniuses of life. When we think of Michelangelo, for an example, here was a person who was obviously a melancholy. Before he did any of the carving of any of the statues that he did, he went down into the morgues and he asked permission to cut up the cadavers and look over all of the actual muscles and sinews in the body. He studied them so that he was not just doing as a sanguine would, just carving out a quick arm, but he was making sure that as he carved it, it had every single fiber in it so that it was representative of a true person. He wanted to do it correctly. He was deep. He was thoughtful. He was introspective. He was analytical. He wanted to do it right. Now, where the sanguine wants to have fun while doing it, and the choleric wants to do it quickly their way now, the melancholy wants to do it right. It must be done right. As my husband says, if there's anything worth doing at all, it's worth doing right. Can I see that? You see, you're great. You're almost a chorus here. It's beautiful how you respond. See, we can actually, as we begin to think this way, it is amazing how the understanding of the temperament does really give you a new comprehension of how other people think. And you can begin to see how true and valid these are as we work with them. So the melancholy the melancholy Michelangelo went down, studied the cadavers, studied the muscles, studied all these things. When he painted the Sistine Chapel, before he got up there on the scaffolding, he had to plan out minutely every single thing he was going to do. If you've seen books on him, you've seen the sketches and the drawings that he did, how he planned all these things out in advance so that everything was done correctly. Every little finger detail that he painted was done exactly as a finger would be. Now, if he had been a sanguine, what would have been different about the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel? The first place, by the time he'd gotten the scaffolding up, he probably would have lost interest in the whole project. Sanguine doesn't hang in long with any certain subject. And if he had decided to do it and had climbed up the scaffolding and got up there in that awkward position, he would have probably found out he'd left the red paint down below. And he'd have to go find it, and maybe he didn't even have any red paint. So then if he didn't have any, what would he decide? We just won't use red. We'll just color it all some other color. And he would do it in a sort of a slapdash way. And he'd start painting at one corner without any idea whatsoever of how he's going to end it up. And just paint. And whatever came out of him is how it would be. And if you didn't like it, too bad. And the first person that criticized him, he'd give up and say, well, I'm going to go off and do something else. Now, you see, it took a genius. It took a Michelangelo. It took a melancholy to be able to do the types of things that he did. Now, as I was sharing with you, we have these interesting drawings here. This girl was sharing with me last time that her husband, who was a deep melancholy, had decided that he would build a stand to put the aquarium on. Now, this is not the aquarium, this is just the stand. And in order to build an aquarium stand, he had to design sets of blueprints for an aquarium stand. And he spent hours and days drawing the exact detail, the measurements, exactly how it was going to be in order to make the aquarium stand so that when he then set the aquarium into it, that it would what? Fit. How? Perfectly. Now, if a sanguine was going to put an aquarium on something, would it really matter what it was on? Chances are the sanguine wouldn't even have an aquarium, because what innately comes with an aquarium that is contrary? Work. Because what are you going to have to do? Not only do you have to remember to what? Feed all the little fish so they don't float to the top dead. That's what happened to mine when I had them. And they all just kept floating to the top dead. And that I never did quite figure out what I was doing with them wrong, but they didn't live for me, that I know. And the sanguine wouldn't want that. Plus the fact, even if they lived, what have you got to do? Clean it. And that's one more thing to do, which we surely don't need to worry about at all. But a melancholy not only wants to have the aquarium and all the problems that are innate within it, but that they want to do it correctly, right, so it fits. So here are 5 pages of blueprints. And when she came up and told me this the last time, I said, oh, I'd love to see those blueprints. I can't imagine 5 pages of blueprints on an aquarium stand. So she's brought them in here to show me today. And she said when she went to take them, he told her she couldn't show them to me in this form because they weren't perfect this way. It's not on the right kind of paper. And so she shouldn't bring this into me until it was on really on blueprint paper. But I'm sure you'll understand that they can kind of picture that far. So here is the blueprints for an aquarium stand, something I've never seen before in my life until this moment. Then she said her son is melancholy just like her husband. He wants to do everything right too. And so she said her son draws maps of the community where they live. And he is how old? 6 years old? Am I correct? 6 years old. And he spends all of his time drawing maps of the community. And here are the maps showing, here's the flag, the American flag over here on top of the post office probably. And here's a sign that says DIP, right down where it is. And she said these are accurate maps of the community. And that when she goes out to go to any store, he keeps these maps with him. And he tells her how to go and where to turn. Isn't that wonderful? Now, what temperament do you assume from what I've already told you that she is? Sanguine. And she got a melancholy husband, melancholy child. She's bound to be a sanguine. And they're both trying to take care of her and get her somewhere. Now, see, we sanguines do need maps. We can't read them, of course, but we do need the maps. And we need somebody to sit there and tell us what turns to make. One melancholy lady told me that when she goes out to go anywhere for the day, that she gets the map out of her area, and she maps out her entire day so that she never has to make left turns. Now, I don't even know why she doesn't want to make them, so that's how far I am from understanding that. But see, she maps out everything so that she never even has to make a left turn and cross traffic, I guess. And so she plans it all out. And I see, only a melancholy could sit down in the morning, first place even have time to sit down in the morning, and plot out every action of the day so that they're turning in the right direction all day long. Now, do you begin to get the feeling of the melancholy? I mean, everything is deep, analytical, thoughtful, organized, analyzed ahead, all of these areas. And you see these temperament traits even in children, as to this little boy who sits down and has mapped out the whole community and has to keep this map with him so that he can keep his mother going in the right direction. Now, you see, here's a little boy at 6 that already knows that mother is somewhat confused. And if we don't plot out life for her, she may never make it one more day. Now, see, that's the way the melancholy thinks. So they are creative and talented and geniuses. They are artistic and musical, philosophical, poetic, appreciative of beauty. When we do the temperaments on a weekend marriage seminar, we divide the couples into groups. We divide them into the sanguines and so forth in the afternoon. And as we send them to different groups, we give them little challenges of what they should do. We say, go and get yourselves into a group and choose a leader. Now, from what you already know, you can imagine what happens. The sanguines, they forget we said to choose a leader. Because the minute they get there and see each other, what do they want to do? Talk. They are so thrilled to see a whole collection of fun, wonderful people like me. They get so enthused and excited that they just get going on all the stories, and they never do get organized. And then when my husband goes around keeping track in his melancholy way of what time it is, and he goes around and says, you only have 2 more minutes, what do all the sanguines scream? Oh, we never chose a leader. Oh, we'd better get going. And then they begin to get organized at the last 2 minutes. You say, you get the cholerics together, and what do they do when it's time to choose a leader? They all want to be the leader. Each one knows how to take charge and get this thing under control. Now, when the melancholies get together, what do they want to do? They want to really organize this whole thing correctly. And they want to get a chart made out. They want to get the thing in columns. They want to get a perspective on it. This is serious business. And they're going to get right down to it. We assigned one melancholy group as they were heading out. My husband said to them, he said, when you get together in your group, would you count up how many people you've got there who are musical? Now, if you had asked the sanguine to count the musical people, what would have happened? They would have forgotten to do it. Now, if you'd asked the cholerics to count up the musical people, they would have said, how many of you are musical? And a group would end, they'd write the number down, go on to the next item. Now, that's the way the two of them would handle it. The melancholies, when told that they should count up how many people were musical, they got in there, and the chairman, by the time he got them pulled together, the one who became the chairman, he was already depressed over the fact that he wasn't sure how to handle this counting of musical people. And as he expressed that he had this problem, he had to somehow count musical people, one other melancholy in the group, and they were really made for each other here, one raised his hand and said, well, first we've got to define musical. Now that sank them all into a gloom. Because how are we going to define musical? So the one suggested that we have to find out whether musical means that you have a musical talent, or whether and can play an instrument, or whether you just appreciate fine music. Now, there's a problem. So they had to debate that for a while, and they decided there was no way you could put those two things together. There would have to be 2 counts. And so they're first going to take up the count of those who play an instrument. Now, the problem there is, one person raised his hand and said, well, does this mean you have to be playing an instrument now, or that you used to when you were a child? Now, I see we got to think that one over for a while. so as they were discussing that, they decided they would have to take two counts of the two counts. One would be for now and one would be in the past. Then one man who really looked disturbed raised his hand and he said, well, what about me? I'm planning to start piano lessons next week. Now, do you see how involved a melancholy can get on what appeared to be a simple question? So by the time this man came back, by the time he stood up to give his report, you see, he had a whole chart made out on musical people and the various forms that went with it, and he gave the report very heavily because he really felt he hadn't done it correctly because it had come out to be such a big and overwhelming project. Now, you see, the melancholy, they do have all of this musical talent. But when asked about this, the whole thing became an overwhelming burden to analyze this whole thing. I did at one time do a seminar on the temperaments to a group of music, that was the music ministry of Campus Crusade. And there were about 80 of them in the group, and they had been traveling all year together. And they, we should have done this at the beginning of the year, but we did it at the end. At least at the end, they understand why it was a depressing trip. But as they traveled around all year together, they couldn't understand why it was generally rather gloomy. And they were always depressed because they never thought they did well enough. And as it turned out, all of them in the group of around 80, all but four, were melancholy. And you see, they then began to understand the problems that they had had all year. And you will find out that in most musical groups, the great majority of them, and sometimes all, will be melancholy. Because only a melancholy can really become an extremely brilliant and talented musician. Because what does it take to become that? Work, dull, dull work, repetitive work, day after day after day after day. Now, what chance is there that a sanguine will ever achieve this? See, not a lot. The choleric may become, if they have a natural gift for it and can put it together fast, they could become competent in some area like this. But the one that has to work for years over the same measure of music, only a melancholy can hang in that long and that devotedly. You see, the melancholy person is a very different temperament. Each one is. But the melancholy in itself is the extremes of talent, of introspection, of analysis, of appreciation of beautiful things. There is a totally different nature. Now, those of you who are melancholy can relate to this very easily. Those of you who are not, it will help you to appreciate the talent and beauty of the melancholy person when you see these abilities and the reason why they function the way that they do. So this is a kind of person that has these talents, these abilities, this creativity. They are self-sacrificing. They will always give of themselves to help someone else. The sanguine doesn't even know you need help, and the choleric will only help you if they can see some good end to come out of it. But the melancholy truly does see problems that other people have, and they're willing to sacrifice. They're analytical, they are conscientious, and they're serious and purposeful. When they tackle something, it's going to be done, and it's going to be done right. Now, as workers, they are excellent at work. They are very schedule-oriented, and they are perfectionists. They want to have it done correctly. They will work at it until it comes out right. I had one lady, a sanguine lady, who married a melancholy man, and she said the first time they were going to go out on a picnic after they just came back from their honeymoon, and she was making sandwiches, and she bought a loaf of white bread. And as she was putting it together, her husband looked at her, and he said, "We can't eat those sandwiches. The bumps don't match." Now, you know the bumps on the bread? She had put the big bump on top of the little bump. And as a melancholy, he could not eat sandwiches where the bumps didn't match. And when she told me that, she said, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that it was important to him that the bumps had to match. As soon as you get calmed down a little, I'll start again. I'm happy to have you have a good time. I just don't want to have to try to yell over you, because if I do by the end of the day, I won't have any voice, and I'll have to call on some other sanguine to get up here. So, One other lady told me that when she got married, she came home from the honeymoon, and she sang when she was an airline stewardess, and everybody had always made over her and said she was cute and adorable. And everywhere she went, people thought she was just so cute. And so she trafficked on that, and she didn't realize it. And then she married a man, and she married a super genius, melancholy choleric, very successful in business. And she thought, now here's my rock, my stability. And which is why sanguines marry melancholy. And so she had married the stable, sound person who was going to take care of her. And that's what happens. The same with Fred. I married him because I figured here's somebody who can really tell me what day it is and shape me up. The only problem was that when we got married and he started doing it, I didn't like it at all. So you see, we don't realize we're not going to enjoy the process. And so she said she got home from the honeymoon and a big moving van pulled up front, and out of it came two huge filing cabinets. And they were delivered, and she said, well, I didn't order those. And they had all the material there. Her husband had signed it, so she had to accept them. And when he came home that night, she said to him, what are these two big green filing cabinets for? And he says, that's so that you can get organized. She said, organize? I mean, what am I to organize? So, I mean, to her, filing cabinets were so far, and she didn't even know what you did with them. She says, what am I going to get organized? He said, you're going to organize everything. She says, what's everything? And he said, well, he said, you have a folder for all the receipts of when you buy shoes. So we have one on shoes. All the shoe receipts go in there. And then everything you buy for gas, when you, all the receipts from the gas goes in the one, the G for gas. And he showed her how to organize the entire house. Well, she said it never occurred to her that getting married, she had to run a big business. And she had to get this whole thing put together. And then he went into the laundry room and he built shelves. They each had children from previous marriages, which is always a challenge in itself to try to meld all them together. And so he built on the shelves above the washer and dryer. He had drawers with the names of each child and whether it was underwear or socks or whatever that went into it, so that when she folded the laundry, which she didn't know you were supposed to do, she thought you just threw it into bedrooms. But when he told her how to fold up the laundry, she had to then put it in all these little boxes that he had made up over the thing, so, and the whole thing overwhelmed her. Now, they actually did not stay married very long. I mean, this whole thing was hopeless right from the beginning. He was not interested in any counsel when I talked with her. He knew he was right, and you see, a melancholy can always prove that he's right because he's got it organized, and his way is obviously better than her way of utter confusion. And since he knew he was right, he was not interested in any counsel whatsoever. He just knew that he would just have to keep going till he found some woman who would like the file cabinets and all of these drawers. Now, the problem is, if you don't have any analysis on this and you do not understand temperaments and you don't know this, what is this man doomed to do repeatedly through life? He's going to keep finding cute, bubbly sanguines that make him feel good. And he's going to have fun with them. And he's going to marry them. And he's going to bring them home. And the minute he gets the cute sanguine at home, he's going to do what every melancholy does. And that's what? Try to instantly make them into melancholies. Now, one of the things we have to understand as we're working with the temperaments is that we accept the other temperament as it is. And we do not try to make it over to become like me. How many years I wasted trying to make Fred lighthearted like me. How many years he wasted trying to turn me into a melancholy. How we both failed to the point that our marriage was only held together because we had two children and felt we ought to hold together for their sakes. So I know what happens when we spend years trying to make people to become like me, because it just doesn't work. And the melancholy has the greatest grip on this because they know they're right, they have thought it all out, they have it analyzed correctly, and they know that anyone would want to be like them if they only caught the vision. Now, as workers, they are detail conscious, persistent, and thorough. They are orderly and organized. They want everything done alphabetically and correctly. One melancholy lady told me that she likes to sit down and read the phone book because it's so organized. Now, that's an extreme, but I thought it was interesting. Sanguines don't even like to look up the numbers, but let alone read it a lot. They can't even find where they put the phone book, if in fact they ever did have one. The melancholy loves research. They love to go off in a corner and think about it by themselves. Now, my adopted son, Fred, is a melancholy and phlegmatic, And you can imagine he and I have never had two thoughts that agreed since we ever got together. And he is thinking entirely differently from me. And one morning he came in, he always looks like the world is resting firmly on his shoulders. And he came in one morning and I said, "Freddie, how are things going with you this morning?" And he said, "Well, all right so far. I haven't run into any people yet." Isn't that a perfect melancholy statement? I haven't run into any people yet. Now, you see, the melancholy can do perfectly fine with all their organization and charts and research if you leave them alone. But if they get messed up with these people who want to have fun out of it and want to just mess it all up, you see, there's really not a lot of hope for them. And they take this heavily upon them. And so hopefully they won't run into any people that will distract them or dissuade them from their purpose. Now, the choleric doesn't want people a lot in their way because they are charging ahead. But with the melancholy, it's that people tend to depress them because people have other ideas and aren't pulled together and organized, and this is offensive to them. So they want it all organized. They love this research. Sense other people's needs. They sense other needs. They sense people's needs. They look around and they know what people are hurting and what problems they have. They can always see the problems. They love the problems. In fact, Freddie only gets excited when something negative happens, like the school burns down. Now that can get him close to euphoria if that happens. They find creative solutions. They are always thinking in the right way to do it, how to analyze it, how to pull it together. The sanguine doesn't care if there's solutions, and the choleric wants instant solutions right now. But the melancholy wants the right solutions creatively done, thought out, and analyzed, and it doesn't matter when. And they need to finish what it is that they start. They really, if they start something, they want to finish it. Now, with the sanguine, getting ready to do it is half the fun. In fact, that's usually all the fun. And I remember back when I used to, in college days, knit Argyle socks. Now, that's a big challenge for a sanguine. In fact, a straight sanguine wouldn't touch it at all. It's just that I had a lot of choleric. I wanted the challenge of the thing kind of intrigued me. And all those little bobbins hanging off it. And so I would work at that and knit an Argyle sock. Now, the choleric of me got me through it because of the challenge. But when I got all through the one sock, how did I feel about starting a second one just like it? No interest at all in doing that all over again. See, so the sanguine, once they've seen they can do it and they see how it comes out, they don't have a lot of interest on doing the other one. The first time we ever got a group of temperaments together, when we lived in Connecticut, we got all the sanguines together one night and we found out that all of us women had knit something where we only did the first one. And that we all had a reserve of one sock or one mitten. One lady knit a sweater and only had one sleeve. She'd never done the other sleeve. And we had one man who built a stereo set and never built the second speaker. So you see, we found out we never cared if we got the second thing done. And a lot of sanguine women have all kinds of material and half-done projects where the fun was going out and buying all the sequins and the glue. But they never really got down to getting into doing it. But you see, with the melancholy, they have to get it done. It's very important that they finish what they start or they'll get depressed over it. And they love charts and graphs and making analysis of things. Now, as a friend, they make friends cautiously. They're really content to stay in the background and they avoid causing attention. Now, right there, you can see potential marriage problems between the sanguine and the melancholy, and they usually marry each other. Because when it says that the melancholy wants to stay in the background and avoid causing attention, now, when you picture a pair, a sanguine wife, for example, and it can go either way. I mean, I've seen sanguine men married to melancholy women. I just have worked with one couple recently of that type. He's never gotten down to business, and he spends money he doesn't have. He's always running around having a good time, and she's sitting home depressed trying to balance the books. So it can work in either direction. But if you picture, for example, a sanguine woman married to a melancholy man, this was Fred and me. We had trouble even going to a party. Now that sounds like, how could you have trouble with that? But when the sanguine and melancholy walk into a party at the same time together, what is the sanguine's aim upon entering the room? causing attention, getting everybody to look at them. They will frequently come in, do some kind of a turn as they enter, have something swishing on, bright and colorful, smell wonderful, and spray themselves, anything to cause attention. And as they come in, the one thing that gears success to them is if every eye in the room turns instantly upon them. Now, a sanguine who can make that kind of an entrance feels her day is made. I mean, she's done it. That's it. Now, she's with a melancholy man. And when he walks into that party, what is his single aim? To hope that what? Nobody notices he came. He does not want to cause any attention. He does not want one eye on him. That makes him feel insecure and that somebody's looking him over and he wants to run for the hills. Now, you see, when the two of them enter a party like that, right there they have a marriage conflict. Because she wants to be seen and he wants to hide. Now, Fred and I worked it out. Before we got into any spiritual help in our lives, we worked it out just on the temperaments in that what we did was he would drive me to the door, let me out. I would go in, make a grand entrance. And after everybody had made over me, then he would quietly come in by himself and no one would notice he came. Now, you see, that's how we worked it out. But you see, telling her all the things that were wrong about her and what she ought to do to get better. Now, you see, only a choleric would take the time to sit down and put on paper all of the things that are wrong with you so that you can shape up and be right. Now, you see, the choleric wants to tell you that. And it's interesting how each of our temperaments responds differently. Now, the melancholy likes to listen to problems. They are problem-oriented, and they will be glad to listen to you forever. They have a deep concern for other people. They're moved to tears with compassion, and they seek the ideal mate. The melancholy wants a perfect partner. This is why melancholies have a great deal of trouble in marriage, is because they want marriage to be perfect. I had one man, one melancholy man, who came up to me after a weekend marriage seminar, and he said to me, the thing that I learned the most from what you had to say this weekend was that I've been taking my marriage too seriously, and I ought to relax and enjoy it. And I see many times a melancholy takes on every project so seriously and so determined that it must be perfect, that when it does not go perfectly, as nothing does in life, then they get depressed. So you see, the melancholy has to realize that not everything is going to go perfectly in life. Before Fred married me, he made a chart out on me. Now, I didn't know that at the time. But he made a chart of listed all the things that he wanted in a wife, all the qualities he wanted. And then he analyzed me in comparison, and he found out that I came out to be about 95% perfect. And what did he feel he had time to do the rest of his life? Shape up that 5%. And as I already shared with you last night, the minute we got home from the honeymoon, he began to put me on the training program to shape up that 5%. Now, what happens when you accept a person as 95% perfect, but 5% of which I am responsible to remake? What happens to that 5%? It gets to 10%. And then it gets bigger. And pretty soon, what is the only thing we can focus on is these negatives that it's my responsibility to remake. And you see what trouble we get into when we try to shape up the things that are wrong in the other person? After a while, all we see is the things that are wrong. And we don't in any way begin to focus on what's wrong with me and what can I do about it. Because obviously, the only control we have in life is to work on our own selves. We cannot change our husbands. We cannot change our neighbors. We cannot change the world. But we can do something about ourselves. And this is what's important. And this is why the concept of the temperament is so helpful in giving us guidelines by which we can function. Now let's look at the phlegmatic. The phlegmatic person is the easiest kind of person to live with. Now, if you haven't found anything that relates to you so far today, and you're somewhat confused, you're probably phlegmatic. Because the phlegmatic has trouble making decisions and figuring out exactly who they really are. So if you've had that kind of problem, perhaps this is where you fit in. The phlegmatic person is the easygoing person in life. They're the easiest to live with, the easiest to get along with, the easiest to work with. They don't really give you any offenses, any trouble, any problems. They are easy going. And as you look at this in the phlegmatic, you see that they have a low-key personality. Now, we've seen already that the sanguine who wants to always have fun out of life usually marries the melancholy who wants to get it done seriously and correctly. They are direct opposites, and they are attracted to each other. They are attracted to each other because the sanguine knows they need some stability, and they see stability in the melancholy. The melancholy is attracted to the sanguine because they know they need some lightness in life and not to be so heavy on things, so they find themselves some bit of sanguine fluff over here that will lighten up their life. Now, you see, the purposes initially are excellent, and if we look only at our strengths, which is what we're doing this morning, we see that the sanguine will lighten up the heaviness of the melancholy, and the melancholy will stabilize the flightiness of the sanguine, and they will, when working on their strength, they are made for each other. Now, before we're married, this is what we see. Now, what happens after we get married? What do we begin to focus on? The negatives and the weaknesses of the other person. And it becomes almost a shock to us that there's something wrong with them. And as we look at this, we find out that here is someone all flighty, that this person wants to get serious, and if he tries to make over this person to become like him, even if he succeeds, and I have seen times when sanguines have become melancholy because a melancholy has worked on them so hard, they've actually become that. But when they get it, even if the melancholy person takes this sanguine and somehow is able to break her and change her and remake her and get her down here to be organized, and she usually turns dreary while doing this. And what happens when he's even got her made into what he wants? What does he realize? That's not what he wanted. He wanted what he got up here. But yet he'll spend his whole married life trying to make her into this kind of person he thinks he wants. And even if he succeeds, he won't like what he's got. And see, that's the differences in the sanguine and the melancholy. Now, we've already seen the choleric. The choleric is a person who wants it my way now, wants to be in charge and to be in control. So what kind of a person does that person tend to marry? Someone who is easygoing and willing to be pushed around. Now, you see, they are the opposites that tend to marry each other. Now, again, this isn't 100% rule. But it many, many times, as we have counseled with couples, we find that the majority of the marriages are sanguine melancholies and choleric phlegmatics. Now, as we look at the phlegmatic, a low-key personality, to be married to a choleric, you almost have to have a low-key submissive personality. If you didn't before, you'll probably get one, because you have to pull everything down and be under their control. The phlegmatic is easygoing and relaxed. Doesn't get too excited or upset over things, just as well, because the choleric is always stirring things up. And it's good if they're married to someone who doesn't respond too positively to all those things or too quickly. They are calm, cool, and collected. Now, I have a phlegmatic mother, and she is calm, cool, and collected. That's her expression. And she was always trying to tell us children that that's what we should be. And there were three of us and my father, all sanguine choleric. Now, there's four of us. We were always whirling up great and wonderful things all the time. And my mother was standing around sighing a lot. And she would look at us and just go, "Oh dear, they'll never amount to a row of pins." One of her expressions. She had a lot of expressions. Phlegmatics have a lot of expressions. And she said, "They'll never amount to a pinch of snuff." I mean, a lot of things we were never going to amount to. We just weren't going to amount to much. She was really worried about what was ever going to happen to people who were not serious, and who couldn't get down to business, and who couldn't get things pulled together in a nice, easy-going way. Now, that's what she wanted. The phlegmatic is well-balanced. They are pretty even every day, and you might add the word patient. They are very patient people. Now, why is it important that they be patient? What are they usually married to? Someone who is extremely impatient, and they need... You see, God puts us together for a reason. And when we work with our strengths, we mesh beautifully. But when we amplify our weaknesses and look only to that, you see, we're into trouble. So here are strengths that are excellent. A patient person usually marries an impatient one. They have a consistent life. They're quiet, but they're usually very witty. The phlegmatic person does not talk a lot, but when they say something, what is usually good about it? Usually has just a little humor, little fun to it, little twist, and you realize that they really did say something. May not have been a lot, but when they said it, it was worthwhile. They're sympathetic and kind. They're good counselors. They keep their emotions hidden, and they're quietly and easily and happily reconciled to life. Now, as workers, The phlegmatic is very competent and very steady. They don't usually rush in to take charge, but they will show up on time and they will do it correctly. Now, if you have two people working on the same kind of a job, and one is choleric and one is phlegmatic, and you give them, and you're the boss, and you give each of them the same job to do, and they each know they've got until 5 o'clock to do it. Now, what will the choleric do? How will they approach it? They'll what? Do it as fast as they can, and they'll get it done when? Sooner. They'll get it done sooner than they have to get it done. And when they finish that, and they're done early, then what will they do? Find another project and get to work, and they'll do something else. Even if it isn't on their job description, they will get to work and they'll do something else. Now, if the phlegmatic knows they've got until 5 o'clock to do it, how long will it take them to do it? Till 5 o'clock. What's the old principle that work expands to fit the time available to do it? The phlegmatic will let it take the full time. Now, they don't want to get done early because if they did, what might bother their conscience? That they get something else to do. And certainly they don't want to look for any more work. And if they do finish early, what do they tend to do? Sit there and wait, because maybe if they just sit there, nobody will notice they're done, and nobody will come by and give them another job. I recently was sitting in a doctor's office, and the receptionist was obviously a phlegmatic. And this doctor is a friend of mine, my nutritionist that I go to, and so she has my book, Blow Away the Black Clouds, in her office in the waiting room. And so I was sitting there, and she had a new phlegmatic secretary, and the secretary was reading my book. So I thought, well, that's good. If she's going to waste time, at least she's wasting it on a good book. And so she was sitting there reading that, and she was being paid by the hour to read my book. Now, I think that's not all bad, but it wasn't what she was supposed to be doing, and obviously she thought that she had done all she had to do. Now, I, as a choleric and a compulsive worker, as I'm sitting there, I look around the office. Now, as I look around, I notice there was a big tree, a plant tree in there, and the thing had shed all over the place. Now, as I see that tree, being choleric and work-oriented, what do I want to do, even though I'm a patient sitting there? Get up and pick up all those leaves and tidy the place up. And I did. I go in and I straighten out her magazines for her, because they're messed up by the time I get in. So I straighten up the magazines, pick up the plants, and I thought it looked droopy and needed water. I had all I could do not to go ask for a pitcher and go water the thing. You see, now I want to take over and get to work there. But the one who's being paid to do that, what's she doing? She's reading my book by the hour to be paid. Now you see the difference in the temperament? Now my secretary is a phlegmatic. And we're a very interesting pair in the office together. In fact, she found a little card, and it shows a person pushing a turtle. And it says inside, "Thou movest me." And she gave that to me. She's got at least enough sense of humor about it that she could see that if it weren't for me pushing her all the time, you see, she wouldn't get to work. I have a phlegmatic friend, and she said to me, we were discussing this one day, I said, "The only way I can take a nap or rest, since a choleric feels that resting is what? A waste of time, because what? You're not producing anything, not achieving goals. So therefore, resting is a waste of time. So the only way that I have found that I can take a nap and rest is that I have to program that as a goal, that in order for me to function X number of hours tomorrow, I must rest from 2 to 3 today. And if I rest there, and that's part of my goal, you see, then it becomes purposeful. And so only if a nap is purposeful can I rest." So I was explaining this to this friend, and I said, "You see, I can only rest and lie down if I know that that's part of my plan. But all the time I'm lying down, what am I thinking? Of what I'm going to do when I get up. So I am going through big programs in my mind so that I'm getting myself ready on what I'm going to do. The minute my foot hits the ground, I'm not going to waste any steps. I'm going to head right into the action." All right, and so then she looked at me and she said, "You know, that's really interesting that all the time you're lying down, you're thinking of how you can get up." She said, "All the time that I'm standing up, I'm thinking of how I can lie down." Isn't that interesting? That just shows exactly the opposite, the points of view of the choleric and the phlegmatic. Now, you see, if we don't understand these principles in life, we think that the person that thinks differently from us, that what? something wrong with them. But you see, when we begin to understand this, we see that someone can be different from me and not be wrong. They're just different. They just have a different nature. So the phlegmatic has this kind of a nature. They have administrative ability. Now, this is a point. I want to be sure in here that in no way do you think that one temperament is more intelligent than the other. We're assuming that everybody here today will assume you're all above average approaching genius. And when we work on that as an assumption, now there may be some of you aren't quite there and some of you are more than there, but wherever, we'll assume that you're about there intelligence-wise. So that the sanguine can be very smart, but never quite achieve what they set out to because they don't get disciplined enough. The choleric is usually extremely smart, but sometimes hits people the wrong way, so they don't get as far as they would if they were a little more gracious in their behavior. And the melancholy is usually genius-prone, but sometimes a little withdrawn and remote from life. And the phlegmatic can be extremely intelligent, but they don't necessarily show it to others. It doesn't come out. My son-in-law is the world's foremost expert on cartoon notes. Now, I see none of you ever heard of them, and you could care less. And this is why I didn't talk about them a lot. But these are the kinds of money that were written in the fall of Khartoum by General Edward Gordon. And at that time, he couldn't pay his troops. He was being besieged by the Saracens. The city ultimately went into destruction. And at that time, to pay his British troops, to keep them from mutinying, he wrote out little money, Khartoum notes. And at that time, he paid his troops in hand-signed pieces of paper. Now, when the fall of Khartoum came, all of those notes were burned and destroyed. All of them were destroyed. However, somehow, some of them had gotten out of the walled city, and my son-in-law has spent his life collecting one of every denomination of all those notes that were burned and are extinct from the fall of Khartoum. Now, that is a very unique and unneeded talent. I mean, there just aren't a lot of people who are after this. And I see he's a phlegmatic, and he has a brilliant mind in this particular area. But you could sit with him three nights at dinner and not know he knew anything. And yet he is called upon to speak on this and is in Europe right now, speaking on gold coin, currency, paper money, and he has the only collection in the world of every denomination of these notes. The British Museum has all but one, but he has every one. Now, see, here is a specialty, a uniqueness, something that he has that nobody here knows anything about at all, or very little at least. And I've learned a lot from him. But he is a person who is intelligent, competent, steady, has a good business, at 30 years old, is extremely secure, has a talent that is much needed today. The gold market has been something fluctuating in the last years. Here is something you see with a unique ability. But he's so quiet about it, and he doesn't talk about it, that if you don't ask him, you don't really know what he knows. Now, the choleric can know next to nothing, and what are they doing with it? Telling you all about it. Now, you see the difference here? And usually they are married to each other. My daughter that's married to him, on the score sheet, she comes out 29 choleric. She could run the United Nations. They'd let her loose with it. Now, you see, and she's married to him, a phlegmatic, consistent, every day. He handles her well, puts up with her whims and her dynamics up and down every day. He is patient, competent, steady. He's able to administer his business and keep it going well on an even keel. And I see here's someone with an extreme gift and someone of extreme intelligence who is in the area of the phlegmatic. One good example to make the phlegmatic clear to people is Gerald Ford, ex-president Gerald Ford. And he is a perfect example of a phlegmatic. He got into the position he got to because he was phlegmatic. At the time that Ford was put in that position, what was it that our country needed that is phlegmatic? What did we need? Calm, stable, easygoing, someone who was not going to stir up controversy. We'd had enough of that. We'd had a choleric melancholy already, and we then needed someone who was going to smooth the troubled waters, someone who was going to hold things under control. And so Ford was chosen because he was a phlegmatic. Now, I'm sure the people doing this did not put that label on it, but it was those traits that allowed him to assume that position. Someone who had won all of the contests he'd been in life, not because he had great grand visions, but because he never offended anybody. And this is the perfect part of the phlegmatic. And I found this article in the Wall Street Journal, and it said this: we are told that Michigan civic leaders are hesitant to begin raising money for the usual type of commemorative museum for ex-President Gerald Ford. One reason, says his old chairman, is that the Ford presidency was a passive one rather than an active one. You see, a phlegmatic presidency, passive rather than active. It was extremely important as a time of healing. And this is so great. The phlegmatic has a healing attitude on things and influence. But how do you make a monument to something that didn't happen? Isn't that interesting? How do you make a monument to something that didn't happen? And then it says the chairman has a point there. For while during the Ford years there was a noticeable let-up in the grand domestic schemes that Lyndon Johnson, choleric sanguine, had, the foreign misadventures, the violent partisanship that had provided most of the drama of American politics for more than a decade. And then it says, come to think of it, the fact that none of this happened, this may make Gerald Ford a leading candidate for the best and biggest memorial of them all, that nothing happened while he was in there. Isn't that interesting? You see, a phlegmatic presidency. And Gerald Ford's asset was something you might want to write down on your phlegmatic page, that the phlegmatic's greatest strength is their lack of obvious weaknesses. And when you read biographies of Gerald Ford, and I have done a political study of most candidates, most political leaders, that when you do a study of Gerald Ford, you find always that in any article about him, it always says, Gerald Ford has no enemies. Everybody on both sides of the aisle likes Gerald Ford. They can't find anything wrong to say about him. Now, you see, he didn't do anything great and dynamic, but what was the good of that? He didn't get us into any trouble either. See, a perfect phlegmatic presidency, one where there was leadership ability, but where it was more important to keep it even than to come up with some dramatic, great, grand new scheme. Now, that's a phlegmatic presidency. So we see that they have administrative ability, they can mediate problems and avoid conflict and are good under pressure, and they find the easy way. Now, phlegmatics are great as counselors. They are willing to sit and listen. They'll hear both sides of the story, and they will give an unemotional judgment, which is excellent. So they are easily led to help and counsel others. Now, as a friend, the phlegmatic is obviously easy to get along with. Now, the sanguine, they're your friend today, but they may forget you tomorrow. The choleric, they don't need you for a friend. The melancholy wants you to be a perfect friend, so they have to judge you so long before they take you on that you may have gotten disinterested by then. But the phlegmatic is an easy friend to have because they're easy to get along with, they're pleasant and enjoyable. They are good listeners, they're very attentive, they don't really care whether they have center stage, they enjoy watching people. They really have a lot of friends, and they have lots of compassion and concern for others. Now, as you see these, the basic temperaments that we've looked at this morning, as we've seen the strengths, you see people who are at exact opposites. You see the sanguine, fun-loving, marrying the serious and purposeful melancholy. You see the choleric, strong and controlling, marrying the easygoing and patient phlegmatic. And as you look at these different strengths in people, you can realize that God made us all different for a reason. He made you unique, and he made you different from the person you married or the person that you work with. No two of us are exactly alike. My daughter Marita and I, when we take the test, we come out almost exactly the same. We're as close as you could probably come up with in people. And yet there are some differences in us. She looks a little different. She weighs a little less. There are some things about her that are a little different from me, even though we come out very closely on the test. You see, there are no two people in the world who are exactly alike. And God created you with exactly the strengths he wanted you to have, and he allowed you to have certain weaknesses in order that when you became aware of them, you could present these weaknesses to the Lord, show them the areas in your life that you're concerned about, and ask him to deal with you in overcoming those weaknesses. Why is it that God likes an impossible situation? Because where does the glory go when there's a change? The glory goes to him. You see, if you were perfect already and had no weaknesses, there'd be nothing for him to work on. There'd be no way for you to have a testimony to show to someone else that because God is faithful, I used to be like this, but now I'm like this. We would have no Christian testimony at all if we didn't have some weaknesses that God could work on to change. Now, as you think about that, don't be discouraged that there are some things in your life that aren't right. Be encouraged that there are many things about you that are good. And as you look over your score sheets, and this afternoon we will go into the weakness area, but as you look over your score sheets this noontime, and you see things about yourself that you haven't been aware of before, remember that you ought to praise God for every strength you've got, and that you are to ask Him to start to work on your weaknesses with you cooperatively. Don't sit back and say, God, if you want me not to have a temper, you're going to have to do it because I just hate everybody and yell at them. Now you see, I'm not saying God couldn't work with a person like that, but it sure gives him a terrible challenge. So if you go to him and say, Lord, I have this bad temper, I want to run everybody and control everybody, or I'm indifferent to things, and I hope you'll help me, and you pray in this area, the Lord can work with us to take our strengths and amplify them into something exciting and great, and to take the weaknesses we have that are offensive to other people and begin to modify and to change them. So as we close our time this morning, let's think right now about the areas of our strengths. And those of you who are melancholy and phlegmatic, sometimes you don't relate well to your strengths because you tend to look at the negative. So those of you who are melancholy and phlegmatic, ask that the Lord will show you some of these strengths that you have, that you can be content in them and happy in them and move on and become even better in those areas. And those of you sanguine cholerics who are already carried away with how great you are, you might ask the Lord to open your mind this afternoon to see some of the areas where you're not quite perfect, some things that need changes in your life. So let's close our morning time in prayer. Our Father, we're grateful that we're together today. We're grateful that you have given us some kind of a tool, a measurement, by which we may analyze ourselves, by which we may see the areas in our lives that are good, that you are happy with, that you're proud of, and that we may later see the areas in our life that are not so good, things that are offensive to other people. Lord, we don't want to get depressed over our weaknesses, and we don't want to get conceited over our strengths. We want to have a balance. We want to be proud of the fact that you've given us strength and praise you for them. And we want to be humbled to the fact that there are things about us that are not just right, that are problems to other people. And we ask that you will deal with us in both our strengths and our weaknesses. And we ask as we sit together at lunch today that we would spend some time in asking our friends what they see in us, in asking them about our strengths and seeing if they agree, asking them about some of our weaknesses and conversing in this area. We know, Lord, that you don't want us to waste time while we're up here. And we just ask that our hearts would be directed in the conversation that you would want us to have. Let's not waste our time on the trivia of life. Let's look at ourselves. Let's get the maximum benefit we can out of the time we're spending here together this weekend. And Lord Jesus, as we part this morning, I ask wholeheartedly that you will minister to each one of us in the way that you want, and that you will also give us a positive direction that we will go home different people, changed because of Jesus. We thank you for this, Lord. In your precious name, amen.